Radio.
Innocent God presents Lulu Michabu, speaking on the topic From Rescued to Rescuer. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn and Australian Catholic University.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Lulu Michabu, and I'm originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I've been working for Caritas Australia for more than 12 years now. I'm very passionate about the situation of women and children in countries where violence, exploitation are part of daily life, and I will tell you why later. I feel extremely honored in speaking to you tonight. I have pleaded with the Lord to direct my thoughts and my words tonight. I will tell you a little bit about how my faith has led me in my current role to oversee some program in Africa. If asked today, what is faith? Faith is something different to everyone. If you ask 100 different people, it is possible that you will get diverse answers. Since the beginning of my childhood, I've learned much about faith and its essence in everyday human life. For me, it is simply real. I've always believed that faith is the belief in God and that Jesus Christ as the Savior of the world. Faith is the basis of testimony and represents sacrifice. Gladly given in moving forward the work of the Lord. Before I begin, let me tell you a little bit about my own land. It is a challenge for me to convey the humanity of the story of my own country of birth without you shutting down, without you quickly turning the page, or without you closing your ears. Whether this day makes a difference or not, you may be the judge of that. I believe that faith is believing and trusting in God. It is having confidence and knowledge that God is on your side. Faith is something you can't see, smell, or taste, hear, or see. Individuals have to believe in their heart that God exists, because the Bible says so. Faith is gained through knowledge of the Word of God. This is why this gathering today is so important. Can I just ask you for a minute to close your eyes? Just for 1 minute. Picture this. Your loved ones. Your parents. Your mothers. Your nieces and nephews. Your aunties. Sisters. Brother-in-law. Everyone you can imagine that make your life so good. Just think of the lovely things that you do together. Open your eyes. Imagine that in that 1 minute you close your eyes. Just that 1 minute, you have lost everyone that you know. Just that 1 minute, you close your eyes. Everyone disappear on the face of this earth. Just think of the state of your mind. That's the life of people in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Just that 1 minute, you lose the whole entire family. That's our life in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The conflict in the DRC is complicated. There are so many antagonists. At least 14 military groups are involved in the fighting, including at least 4 foreign armies, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and a lot of malicious groups. They operate mainly in the east of the DRC, where the central government has largely lost control. My country has been plundered by the colonialist Belgium, and now we are killing ourselves. It is a desperate situation. And of course, like any other war or conflict everywhere, women and children are the ones who suffer the most. The statistics are impossible to fathom. It is estimated that during the Second Congo War in 1998, more than 3.8 million people died. Many by non-direct causes, such as preventable diseases, common to areas where poverty and famine dominate. 2.1 million excess deaths are estimated to have occurred since the end of the war, and the fighting continues. Murder and death are one thing, yet tragedy is not restricted to death. Sexual violence is out of control. Those who suffer rape and other form of sexual violence often suffer far beyond the trauma of the actual event. Rape in the Democratic Republic of Congo is both a weapon and consequence of war. Though no statistics are officially kept, at a minimum, tens of thousands of rape and mutilation have been taking place during the past decade. Victims, meanwhile, have a little hope of seeing the rapists brought to justice, yet constantly fear of seeing him in the street, field, or marketplace. Before I tell you my story, I'd like to say a prayer. Heavenly Father, we come to you today asking for your guidance, wisdom, and support as we begin this talk. Help us to engage in meaningful discussion. Allow us to grow closer as a group and nurture the bond of community. Fill us with your grace, Lord God, as we make decisions that may affect our lives, and continue to remind us that all that we do here, all that we accomplish, is for the pursuit of truth, for the greater glory of you, and for the service of humanity. We ask this thing in your name. Amen. Sorry, I keep changing my mic. When I tell my story, I like to face you, because this is from my heart. Are you able to follow me at the back there? Yeah. I said to you before, I'm from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I was born in the Katanga region in the Congo. I'm not going to say my age, but as I speak, you guess. I'm still young. Anyway, this morning before I woke up, I was really nervous to come and speak to you. So I went to my daughter's bedroom. I knock and I say, you know what, I'm really nervous. Can you pray for me? She looked at me as if I was mad. She said to me, why? I said to her, you need to pray for me because I'm really nervous. She said to me, it's not that Guinness and God you're going to? I said, yes. She's only 10. She goes, so what do you want me to pray for you? God will be there. So I said, thank you very much. That's all I needed. So came back and started thinking about that. But my story, I hope at the end of it, maybe you can gain something of it. My story is about my own faith. I was brought up in a family with 4 brothers and one sister. Unfortunately, the four brothers came before me. I was the first and number one girl, number five. In my country, it's very difficult to find a girl like me who went to school and finished their study. When I was little, I was growing up happy because my father, not like many people, had an opportunity to work for the government in the Congo. So I was very lucky. I was going to school like everyone else. But just in primary school, when I finished year six, I noticed that most of my friends, nearly I'll say 50%, didn't go to high school. I didn't know why at the time. I keep asking myself the question, why they've been forced to stay home? I didn't understand at that time. As I was going to high school, I noticed the number keep dropping. And parents could force the girls just to get married because they're not worth. They're not going to carry the family name. They'll get married and leave home. That's tradition. Not fair for girls. I start noticing that. By the time I finish high school, I could count everyone on my hand. Most of them got married, forced to leave school, and you never hear from them anymore. I asked my father, why is that? My father, of course, said to me, you know, girls have to get married. Why invest in them? It's like, wow. This is not what you told us, because we were very Catholic family. When I was growing up, my father told us about believing in God, praying your faith and all that. So to me, it was like, okay, fine. But what I asked him, what will happen to me? My father said, eventually we'll figure that out soon enough. When I finished high school, came back to my dad. I was quite smarter than my brother. I said to my father, I need to go to university. My father looked at me and said, you know what? I lost my job. And the money that I have is for the boys. You could get married if you want to. Or you could stay home, take a year off. The message was very clear. I had to get married. Good for me, I was not forced to get married to a husband that I didn't like. But I got married to somebody really that changed my life. My husband. My husband was working for a human rights organization. He had some sense in him. When he got married to me, he said to me, one of the first things he said to me, you need to go back to school. You need to go and finish your education. I couldn't believe it. I was in tears. Yes, I did. I went back to college, started studying like anybody, but I also get involved with what he was doing. So I started working part-time for the human rights organization. Just remember, Democratic Republic of Congo is a French-speaking country. We do not speak English, we speak French as a national language, and we have other four languages. So forgive me if I can't pronounce all the stuff together. I keep going into French and English and stuff like that. But anyway, I started working for the human rights organization. I start now learning about rights. And I start noticing the injustice, discrimination. And I couldn't keep quiet. I start speaking about it. In my country, at that time, we were under dictatorship. So we, if our president say jump, you say how high? Say to you that you have to. We didn't know about freedom. Named a free election. In my life, the first time I had the democratic election was here in Australia. When I was growing up, I didn't know that. So I got so excited. I started saying, going to prison, seeing all these women that they've been detained for nothing at all, just for speaking out, sometimes just for dressing up as European. That's it. That's all it takes. We never wear pants in my country. We just wear our traditional clothes and stuff like that. For stuff, because I stood up as a woman and said something was not right, that was my crime. That's all I did wrong in my country. Just because I stood up and I say this is wrong. The government did not like it. They didn't like what we were doing. The Secret Service started coming over. They started coming to visit us. And they give us first warning. And it's not like here they do here. People come to you at night and knock and say, we don't want you anymore to work for this organization. You are collaborating with Amnesty International, so you are giving details away, so stop from today. I couldn't believe it. Me and my husband, we say to ourselves, if we really want to do what we do, we should continue doing what we believe in. At that time, I was just praying to God every minute. When I wake up, that tomorrow will be a good day. But my struggle was really about to begin. One day, I stood up and packed my children, my two kids. I had already two kids. Let's go to the market. Like every woman goes to the market to buy food, we were doing all that on our way back. I just saw a neighbor coming to me. The neighbor was rushing. Say to me, you can't go there. I'm like, why? The police are at your house. They've got your husband. If you go there, that's it for you. This is the time I had to make a decision. I had 1 minute to make a decision. Do I go there, where my husband been detained, or do I save my children and my life? 3 seconds. I love my husband, but we had a chat before. If something like this ever happened, save your life. I couldn't go back to my parents, or to my brothers, or to anybody else to ask for help. Because they will be, that's the first place they will be looking for me. What I did, I make a choice. I didn't want to go back. I packed my children, I just grabbed my children and catch the bus, wherever the bus was going, I was going there. I didn't even know where I was going. I was living in the Katanga province, and the nearest country was Zambia. And my thought was like, I have to leave this country, but how? I didn't have enough money, I didn't have my papers, I didn't have anything. But I had to do something. So, me and my two children, my daughter was 6 and the other one was 4. We had to walk for 2 days. 2 whole days to get to the border. I didn't go to my parents, I didn't go to my husband, but I didn't know what happened to my husband. I didn't know if he was alive, if he was killed. I didn't know. All I could do is pray. All I could do was cry and pray that he was alive. But I knew already, if they got him,
the chance of him to survive was like 15%. How do you explain to your two kids and say that your dad may be alive or dead? Don't know. But I had to get to the next place with no money, with no identification, and with my two children. We walk and walk and walk 2 days. We slept on the road. When we reached the border, we had to wait until it was midnight for us to cross the border. And the police were shooting at any movement. Maybe if you know the geography about Congo, at that time there was no much border. There was a bit of forest and then little things there, you just cross and that's it. So at night, me and my children, we had to lie on the ground. When they start shooting, we go down. And we wait until it was quiet for us to cross the border. In my heart, I'm praying for the survival of just all my children. And once they start shooting, so that they don't scream. And we will stay there for about 20 to 25 minutes. Regardless what bites you, you're not going to move. It was very sad. But we managed to cross the border. But we crossed the border to Zambia. It's an English-speaking country. I didn't have the language. How do I communicate to these people? How do I ask them to help, for help? I didn't know what to do. All I could do is take a charcoal. I don't know if you know charcoal, but I just write UNCR. And just asking people, and everybody who passed by, and they will ask me for money. They were telling me, you have to go to Lusaka, but to get there, you need money. And they didn't have the money. People, one person, the bus, I went where the bus were, I saw the bus, but I'm asking them, showing them what I wrote on my hand. And the bus driver said, you have no money. I said, no money. He asked me for my necklace, my watch, and he looked at us and said, I want your shoes. So we had to give our shoes. My kid, I had to explain to a 4 and 6 year old that we need to give these shoes. We gave the shoes, we gave the necklace, we gave everything that we had, just to get us from Kasumbalesa, which was the border, to Lusaka. It's unbelievable. But we had our faith, we keep praying. I was praying with my kid every minute. When we arrived in Lusaka, it was very hard for me because also I forgot to tell you I was pregnant with my children, my two children, and being pregnant and going through all that. They gave us a form, we fill up the form and why we were there and stuff. And then they gave you a tent, a few plates, and they said, just wait here. The truck will come and get you. Take us to the camp. First of all, my kid never been in that situation before. All they can do is cry. I had to tell them it's okay. But that's the time where I feel the most vulnerable person in the world. I was prone to all violation. People could just do whatever they wanted, if they wanted. When I reached the camp, people were asking money to help me put the tent. I did not have money. People were asking me to trade the plate that I got so that they can help me. Some people did, but I had my faith. I was praying to God. I didn't lose that. That's one thing my dad did so well that I keep praying and thinking, God will hear my prayer. And every day I'll pray. I don't know if my husband is alive, I don't know if my parents are alive, but I'll just pray every day for 3 months. For 3 months, every day I wake up, I pray, and I say to God, please let my husband appear here one day. My husband was, when he was detained, he was tortured. And he was left for dead. They sent him, they were transferring him from the prison to the hospital when our organization actually rescued him. He was nearly dead, they didn't know if he would survive. They took him to Zambia, to the hospital there, and we didn't know that he was there. He didn't know where we were. It was very difficult for us. And after three months, one day we stood up and we were waiting with my children like every day and hoping for a miracle. And I saw my husband coming. I wasn't sure because I couldn't even recognize him. A grown up man was like 36 kilos, maybe, or 38 kilos. You could not even see, you could see just the bone. I couldn't even start even. I was looking at him and I'm thinking, is that you? And he just looked at me and we just start crying. My kid could not believe it. We just cried. But, and pray. It was very hard for me to just see him in that condition, and I could not do anything. But I was happy, at least he was there. But boy, oh boy, the camp, that's when I make the connection. I made a promise to God. I said to God, I talked to God, I don't know, maybe you think I'm crazy, but I do. I said to God, you know what? If you let me out of this misery, I promise, I would dedicate my time to help women like me. Women who have lost everything. I'll come back, God, please help me. I'll do the same prayer every day. When we were called to go back to hear about our application for refugee status, as things do get worse, but this time they're getting even really bad. The Zambian government said to us, because at that time they had very good relationship with Congo, diplomatic relationship, and they say, you are political refugees, and we won't keep you here. We're not going to give you refugee status in Zambia. You either be deported, or you find a third country that is willing to take you out of here. We give you 48 hours to leave the country. 48 hours. I was shaking. And I knew if I go back, that's it. That's the end. I was so upset with God. I started crying. I didn't know. On our way back to the camp, we saw a church. I said to my husband, I didn't even care what church it was. I said, let's go in there. Let's go do our final prayer. We went inside the church. We sat there. It was Anglican church. I didn't even know. I was so confused. Just sat there. And mass was done. And next to us There was this white lady sitting next to us. We didn't know who she was. And I'm praying to God, I'm saying, this is the last thing that I have to do. And I know if I die, please let me die together with my family. I'm just saying that to God. And then at the end of the service, they invite all of us to come and share something to eat. And the lady next to us just keep talking to us. It's like we didn't even understand what she was talking. My husband could speak a little bit of English. And I was like, what did this lady want? And my husband said, you know, she just wants to know why we're here. So my husband starts telling the lady our story. And she said, listen, this is what happened. We've been given 48 hours to leave this country. And we don't know what to do. If we don't find somebody else to take us, we'll be deported back to Congo. And we, you know what will happen to us and my family. The lady looked at me, at my husband and at me, I was really in tears. And she said, you know what? Come to my office tomorrow. And she gave us a business card. She was the Australian Eye Commission. Unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. And God, he gave me my miracle that day. Unbelievable. If you never witnessed that, I did, actually. It was unbelievable. She said to my husband, come and see me tomorrow morning. And this is my card. We couldn't believe it. We didn't even sleep. We didn't even know about Australia as much. I knew the way indigenous of Australia living here. I didn't know anything else. We had to research about Australia now. What's in there? But we couldn't sleep that night. The next morning I was there at 6 a.m. And I know the office, they open at 9:30, but I didn't care. I was there, we were there, and our children and my husband, we were there. By the time she comes, she said, you just got here? I said, yeah, yeah, we just got here. But we were there since 6 a.m. I think she could tell. And then she called us in, we went in, and guess what? She gave us the phone and said, fill this one in and take it to UNCR. And tell them Australia is willing to consider your application and you won't be deported. I just started crying. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. We just filled the form, take it to UNCR and say, this is what happened. They couldn't believe it. It was our miracle. And now I have to keep my promise. You know, I made a promise with God that if you do this for me, I promise that I will help people like me. Unbelievable. My story. I hope this inspires you. If you don't believe in God or you don't believe in anything, this is unbelievable. So we went there, filled up the form, everything was done. 3 months later, we were in Australia. 3 months later. Unbelievable. I know there is stories of long lists, waiting lists and stuff, but God was on our side. And he knew how much we really suffered. So when I arrived in Australia, I arrived in a new country with three children actually. My baby was born then. My husband, with no English, was really surprised. Just arrived in Australia, in a new country. Bear in mind, I never get in touch with my family back home. They don't know if I'm alive or not. I don't know if my family survived or not. But I was happy I made it to Australia. But it was not the end. I had to do something about myself. I had 3 girls. Imagine their life if we didn't come to Australia. 3 girls. arrived here, it was unbelievable.
I started learning English, I started going back to school, my kids started learning here, and I said to myself, I promise God, I need to give back to people like me that are still suffering, still in the same position, and so vulnerable to violence and to everything, exploitation, all that. I need to do something. I was looking for an organization to work for. In 2000, finally, I found Caritas. That was a perfect match. I needed to contribute to something that I know. I know all this work is important, but for me, I needed to do that. So when I found Caritas, it was something that I was looking for, something where I could see, I could make a difference in people's life. Not to so many, but at least one person at a time. And I started working for Caritas Australia. I think my boss saw my passion about women and children and said, you know what, you have to work in this program. Start working with women and children. It was fantastic. For 7 years, I was not in contact with my family. I didn't know if they were alive or anything like that. For 7 years, we're living and not knowing. I start writing letters, sending it around, just to see if people will respond. And one person respond and say, yes, I know this person was one of my uncle. I didn't identify myself. I just write like I was looking for somebody. So I got that letter. I start crying. The first day I spoke with my father on the phone, all I could do was cry. When I left the country, my brother was killed because they went looking for us and they couldn't find. They took my brother and he was tortured and he was killed. How guilty. He had 4 kids. My mom did a funeral for me. She refused to give up, but she said after 5 years, they didn't know if I was still alive. And they had to cry for 3 people, and including my husband, that was 4. And people were saying to them, you know, that's what we told you. If you let the girl get an education, and that's what happened. She was really feeling guilty. But when she hear my voice, she just cried. She said, thank you. That's all I needed. We prayed and prayed on the phone. Because we thank God. It's not often that you find your family. Sometimes you go back, you don't even see anybody. Took me nearly 10 years to go back to the DRC. I changed completely my identity. People won't recognize me. The first day I went back, I was shaking. Mobutu was the dictator, left power. So I was a bit comfortable to go there, but I was still scared. But I knew that I needed to go back to find the closure. I needed to go back to see the situation of women. And I went back. I never stopped. I keep going back to work with these people because I know how vulnerable they are. Not only the situation has improved, but it's gone really bad. It's not just conflict anymore. It's about sexual violence. Rape is now a tactic of war. They rape women so that they have control over them. A rape woman in Africa, in the Congo in particular, has no value. Once you rape a woman, she'll be chased out of the community. Nobody will claim her, no one will want to talk to her. And she has no right to land,
and they end up in the street. And that way, I think the husband is also traumatized because the shame that brings to them, they run and the militia group take control over the land. And you know why? Because of our demand. Our demand on cell phone, laptop, all these electronics that we need to feed our need. There is a mineral called coltan that is exploited illegally in the Congo and is in big demand. For a mobile phone. So when we make our phone call, let's think about women in the Congo. Let's think about how many girls and women have been raped. Let's ask questions. To all the phone companies, electronics, where do they get the content from? Is this from the DRC? Do they have blood in their hands? Before you didn't have the information, but now you do. What are you going to do about it? My story is a sad story, but it's a story of hope. It's a story of endurance. It's a story of courage. It's a story of whatever you call it. I'm very, very committed to contribute and make a difference, especially in women and girls in the DRC. I hope today you take something from my story and use it. Tell it to somebody else. My story is just one story, but there is millions of women in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They will tell you similar stories. The last time I went to the DRC, I cried. I saw a little young girl. I was in Eastern Province. I saw a little girl, and I was doing a tour just to see the women at the program. And that's very sad because I asked the people there, why this girl is so isolated? They didn't say to me anything. And you know, they're very polite people. We're very polite, we don't say things in group. And then somebody pulled me aside. I said, what? She said, oh, she's smelling a bit of weed. I'm saying, oh, that's all? Because, yeah, you know, nobody wants to talk to her. I'm thinking, oh, it's just a kid that pee on his pants and something like that. That's all. But it wasn't. The kid was only 6 years old. And she was a victim of, she was raped by a militia group. The family did not have enough money to take that kid to the hospital. And the kid was suffering. And because everything on her was damaged, so just the weed keep coming out and they can't stop it. And the kid was getting really sick. And if we were not there, she could be dead by now. When they started explaining to me, that's what happened to this kid, I was petrified. How could you let kid like that standing there and you not doing anything? And they tell me, you know what? It's not her, only her. There is so many of these kids here. But we don't have enough funds to help these people. So we just let them stay like that. And the poor kid, I was so touched by it, we had to take that kid to the hospital. Quickly, we stopped everything and we took that kid to the hospital. Unfortunately, there is only one gynecologist. What's that? Yeah, exactly. Only one. in the country. Just 1 for 100,000 people. So he was not there. He was in training in France. Guess what? No one could do that. No one could help that child. And the child died. Because only 1 for 100,000 people. And this is happening in this century. It's not that I want you guys to feel really guilty about what's happening in the world, but I'm asking myself a question. Why this is not in the news? Why this is not making the headline? Why this is not on the news? Since from 1998 to 2003, 5 million people died from that conflict. 5 million, the entire population of Kenya, gone. And nobody is talking about it. No one, it's not making headline. How fair are we? How fair? I'm sure that you have all seen images of Africa on television or in the newspaper and would have heard the devastating stories of lives lost, people suffering, and destruction upon this continent. You would have heard the glimmers of hope as people have been rescued. I'm sure that many of you are thinking, how can we help? Why should we help? It is so far away. Where do we start to build? When there is nothing. Or maybe you are questioning whether aid money gets through. I know that at the time it is easy to be cynical, and you might wonder whether corruption in the country we let aid through to the people that in need. Although the situation is tragic, there is hope. Every day, Caritas Australia and local partners are supporting people in need around the world through sustainable aid and development work. We are assisting them to break free from the cycle of poverty, regardless of their ethnic background, political beliefs, gender or religion. Caritas Australia works hard to make sure that as much as aid possible actually reach those in need. If you haven't heard of Caritas Australia, I'm sure you would have heard about Project Compassion. It is a way of us partnering with the Australian public to raise important funds for the overseas project in some part of Australia. It is our main source of funding. This year, the theme is Open Doors into the Future. It's about children, younger people, and community who support them. This is just not one of many stories. This is not just one story. It's many stories that people in my country tell. Rape has become a weapon of war. Women, once violated, are often ostracized from their community. Sexual slavery is common. In the 9 months from the beginning of 2009, more than 7,000 reports of sexual violence were recorded by the UN. This is, of course, just a tiny sample of the reality of the situation, as so many women who suffer never get the opportunity to come forward. Why are they fighting? The violence has been ongoing for so long now. For many, it is even difficult to remember what the conflict is really about. Fundamentally though, the fighting in the DRC is about resources. The DRC abundance of natural resources has been a present challenge for civilians in the country and a prime example of so-called resource curse affecting many developing countries. Both foreign and internal powers have long sought to establish control over the national natural resources. Civil war, corruption, and social infrastructure are the result. The people of DRC, who should be the beneficiary of its natural wealth, are the same people who suffer greatest in the wake of this struggle. I often look at my girls and I see how happy they are. They have difficulties in Australia, many difficulties that the third and the fourth generation of Australian may be difficult to understand. But compared to many of the girls of and women of the DR Congo, their lives are a breeze. That it is why I continue to fight for these women. In Congo, Caritas Australia does not rely on outside experts to fly in and fly out stuff. Our people there are from the DRC. They are the ones who are finding the solution to poverty and they're building peace for themselves. The people of DRC can live a better life. In a way, it's up to you. Will you turn the page on the atrocity happening in the DRC? Or will you hold this group to account and deliver a better future for the people of DRC? As I said before, you may not know this, but at this very moment, the war in the Congo is very likely hidden in your pocket. Yes, in your pocket. As I said before, the war in Congo is fueled by the demand of resources. DRC is the main repository in the world where coltan is found. Coltan is crucial and in making pinhead capacitors which store power and information in your mobile phone. There is no substitute for coltan, and it is constantly exported out of DRC. In large part, the conflict is due to this threat and the quest to control it. Is your mobile phone contributing to the conflict in the DRC? Why don't you ask your phone company, mining companies, both from Australia and international countries, are responsible for the mining industry in the DRC. We need this company to be transparent in the way they deal with the government of Congo as a first step and reinstating the rule of law and ensuring the people of DRC are getting the fair due. They dream to participate in rebuilding their own shattered lives and of their nation is depend on your commitment to help make that dream a reality. How we respond to the gender crisis in the Congo will reveal how the free world measures up to its belief in our own ideas. I'm appealing to you on behalf of Congolese women for help, as I believe that together we can make a difference. Let us extend solidarity and sincerity to the women of DRC. Let us wipe the tears of a nation of pain in pain. As the Blessed Mary Makilov said, never see a need without doing something about it. By supporting Caritas Australia Project Compassion, you are truly meeting the need of the most vulnerable. Let us extend solidarity and sincerity to the children of DRC. Let's wipe the tears of a nation of women and children and family in pain. So as I come to the end of my presentation, I'd like to thank you. Not just to, you came here to listen to me. It's just one story. As I said, there is many, and we need your support. I'd like to thank Nick. For the first time when I had a conversation with him, and he said to me, I want you to be the guest speaker. I didn't know what to think. It's like, what? I said, yeah, I want you to come and speak to everyone. I said to him, what do you want me to speak to them about? Your story. I'm like, okay, my story. I hope tonight my story touch your heart. I just hope that my faith I needed to share with you. I hope this will help you in your everyday decision or commitment. Whatever you do and decide about this talk tonight, it's up to you. It's up to you. Let's help these women and children. So thank you.
That was Lulu Machabu with From Rescued to Rescuer. Guinness and God is presented once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more shows, interviews and talks, visit cradio.org.au.